Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online and apps. Coming up on episode 23 of the World Soccer Talk podcast, we discuss our opinions about which will be the most popular European soccer league on US TV in the next decade, our analysis of NBC's trip to England and Fox's coverage of MLS and Champions League from this past week, plus important news for cord cutters who want NBC, and much, much more, including questions from you, the listeners. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined today by Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
All right, Kartik, let's dive right into what we've been watching this past week. And the big one, and we previewed this last week, was NBC's coverage, Premier League road trip to England for, it was about 3 days of coverage. They were there, I think, about 4 days doing some prep. But what's your initial thoughts on this one compared to previous years? And let us know which bits and pieces that you got to see.
Yeah, I watched basically the whole thing. The absence of Arlo White was noticeable, obviously. His wife was having a medical procedure, he announced on Twitter, and Steve Bauer had to do double duty. He was the host in the gantry, and then as well calling each of the matches where they were on location. So busy weekend for Steve Bauer. He did very well, as he always does, and I thought was on the mark, particularly considering they were rotating partners for him, right? Every broadcast. Now, of course, he's worked with all of these guys, whether it be in the studio or in a broadcast before. I like the inclusion of Phil Neville on Saturday at White Hart Lane. That was a nice touch. Not someone we always see on U.S. television. We see a lot of them, hear a lot of him, but I thought that was very good. My thinking was that you got a really interesting perspective with Graham Lusseau and Lee Dixon serving as essentially studio analysts during the weekend. It just kind of a different take on, you know, it's funny how, and we kind of got into this with Robbie Musto in the interview we did last week with him, how you approach things differently if you're going to be a commentator, an analyst in a studio, or even if it's an on-site studio like this was, and how you have more time to kind of analyze and make your points than you do necessarily when you're the co-commentator on a broadcast. And Graham Lusseau is a very intellectual, very articulate, sees the game in a way that many others don't. And I really enjoyed having him be able to deliver 30, 45-second responses, even minute responses to Steve Bauer and Rebecca Lowe's questioning. So I really enjoyed that. I thought Lee Dixon excelled in the role also. It's a role he's had previously at different networks in the UK. But I like the change up. And it's one of those things where it was so good that I'm disappointed we don't get to see this maybe once a month or once every 2 months with Robbie Musto as the co-commentator, who was excellent, Kyle Martino as the co-commentator, who was also excellent, Robbie Earle, who has a background of being a co-commentator on Premier League games. I think when the Premier League first became popular in this country, we heard Robbie Earle's voice a lot on international feed broadcasts that came over Fox Soccer Channel and Satanta Sports. So those of us who've watched the league for a long time are accustomed to him doing those games. And Dixon and Lusseau as studio analysts who can elaborate more on their points. And then, of course, there was the interviews capped off by Arsene Wenger coming out. Obviously, Lee Dixon, a player who played for him. And when you're making the tactical change three at the back, Wenger, of course, jokes, well, I may not have to do that if I have Dixon back there, like then Steve Bould and when I came into Arsenal. So a really good weekend, and it was so impressive to see the likes of Mauricio Pochettino, Eddie Howe, Arsene Wenger, and prominent players, Stuart Downing, etc., come out, and Harry Kane come mm-hmm. out and talk to them.
Yep. My thoughts on this one was that I think the star of the show this past weekend was Steve Bauer, and it just showed how much of an asset he is to NBC Sports. I mean, not only he was multi-versatile. So he stepped in for Ola White in terms of the commentary. I think Ola was going to do much of the commentaries, and Steve was going to do more the pitch side hosting. Steve Bauer did the commentary, and then he ran down from the gantry to the pitch to do pitch side as a host. In previous weeks, we've seen him come on the show as an analyst, kind of from the BBC studios, sharing his opinions and the latest news. But I mean, to me, I mean, he did a fantastic job doing all of that. Ola White, it's a shame that he wasn't there in terms of his wife having surgery. Hopefully she's getting better. To be honest, though, I didn't miss Ola that much. I mean, I like him. I just don't think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. And I think without Ola White, they were able to scramble and do the best that they could without him. But there wasn't a big miss. If there was a miss, it was sometimes, actually, I think it was like halftime. It was halftime on pitch side at Old Trafford. And, it was, I think, Robbie Earle and Graham Lasseau, on the pitch. And then, I guess Steve Bauer, wasn't able to come down for the pitch side for that one. And then so Robbie Earle had a host a little bit, and he was a little bit unsure of himself. He's not used to being in that role as kind of a pitch side host. So it's a little bit uncomfortable. I mean, he did fine, but you could definitely tell that.
And which game was it that he was essentially by himself at one point, not even with Lasseau? Was it the Monday game? Because Steve Bauer, yes, it was the Monday game because Steve Bauer had to run down and do pitch side. So Robbie Earle was left by himself for commentary after the match, and Rebecca Lowe threw it back to him, and it was just him.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, that part I thought he did well. I just that on the pitch, whether he was nervous or whether he just wasn't used to being kind of that pitch side host, it was a little bit uncomfortable. It was fine. It worked out okay. But that was the only, over the entire weekend, that was the only weakness I saw. And I thought in terms of, you were missing Ola White in that instance, where if Ola was on the pitch, he'd be able to kind of face the camera a little bit more and talk, hand it over to Robbie Earle to get his opinion.
But this begs the question, though. I mean, and we're very comfortable with Ola White and his style of commentary. A lot of people are comfortable with it. The kind of radio introduction, a lot more elaboration on commentary, perhaps, than a Martin Tyler, etc. Steve Bauer has his own style, and obviously, Bauer, you've just gone through it. He does three different things for them. He serves as an analyst from the BBC studio during the course of the season, giving tidbits, news, and analysis and commentary. He can serve as a host, as a studio host, as a pitch side host, as we've seen him. That's the role I think he's been used most in NBC. And then he can serve as a match commentator. Mm-hmm. Do you sense any difference in style and maybe preference for the listening audience, Bauer versus White? Because I think now everybody is very comfortable with Steve Bauer. It's as if two seasons ago when there were games that Steve Bauer would do, people would notice and say, oh, well, Ola White's not there, it's Steve Bauer. This weekend, I didn't see those sorts of tweets. I said, oh, yeah, it's just natural. Steve Bauer's calling Manchester United Chelsea. That's kind of expected.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's one of those things that I think Ola White, I think what we have learned from this past weekend is that he's not irreplaceable. So, I mean, if something happened down the road where Ola got picked up by Turner Sports, as an example, Steve Bauer could fit into that role comfortably and be in some ways more versatile in terms of the types of things he can do. Of course, he does work for BBC Sport too. So they probably would have to offer him a full-time position with NBC Sports. I think we're all now kind of used to Steve Bauer and we're comfortable, and I think there seems to be more fans of Steve Bauer than there are of Ola White in terms of just the comments we hear either on social media or on worldsoccertalk.com. I think they're both good. They both have different styles, and I think as a team, as an approach, it works really, really well together. And having Steve play backup at times or play the lead role if Ola's not available. But all in all, I think the one thing I kind of got from this past weekend, Kartik, was that just what a good team they have at NBC Sports. There's a really good chemistry. It seems natural and authentic. Sometimes with Fox Sports, it seems forced, where you have kind of Warren Barton, who doesn't seem to get along with Stuart Holden on set, Lallis, who doesn't seem to get on with Friedel on set that much, and they're kind of almost like thrown together like a pack of wolves and having to sort themselves out. But with NBC, it definitely feels like a family with, you know, Kyle, Rebecca, the two Robbies, Lee Dixon, Graham Lasso. It just feels like an extended family for the viewer. So it's a really comfortable viewing experience as a viewer watching these games and then watching the pre-match, I mean, halftime, post-match. I mean, those are things we look forward to sometimes just as much as the games. And you can't say that about other broadcasters. You want to listen to what they have to say. But you also feel an attachment to them and kind of a camaraderie that they have between them. It seems natural. And that's something I don't think you can find anywhere else in the U.S. in terms of soccer coverage.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much of the Fox dynamic is contrived and how much of it is genuine. guys disagreeing and not liking each other. But that's I think, a style that Fox has cultivated. But, yes, there's this kind of a very family feel to it, which is, it's like television of yesteryear in the United States or in Great Britain, where you have somebody who comes into your home once a week or twice a week, and you feel very comfortable with and very soothing watching them give coverage, and you have this level of trust in them. And I think the NBC studio team has achieved that through the course of these last 4 years. And there were people who want to see their exploits on the road. There were people who were tuning into Facebook Live to check out and Twitter and everything to check out Arlo, Graham, and Lee's excellent adventure the day that they were racing through London doing two games in one day. And I can't imagine that happening with a crew from Fox or a crew from ESPN or from whoever else. So they have developed that, and I felt like it was just a good a feel good weekend. I just wish they could do it more, because I want to emphasize again, I enjoyed the change of pace with Lee Dixon and Graham Lasso, both of whom are very seasoned and very good at articulating and elaborating on the points they make. Mm-hmm. And they don't always get the chance to do that during the course of a match in a studio or in a pitch side setting, and having Musto, Earl, and Martino as co-commentators. And both Kyle Martino and Robbie Earl have a lot of experiences. Actually, Robbie Musto does too. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it was calling games off of studio, but he did if you used to watch Serie A or La Liga online, I mean, if you watched it on television, you didn't necessarily see him, but if you watched it online, you are used to Robbie Musto's voice in the late 2000s. This is in the United States only. But so they all have an experience with it. And as we heard from Robbie Musto last week, he'd like to do more of it. And I'd like to hear his voice more on those broadcasts. And same with Kyle and Robbie. That doesn't mean having them call games off studios from Stamford. That means flying them to the UK. And if there's a weekend or two where you can fly Lee Dixon and Graham Lasso to the States, maybe that would work as well.
Yeah, it's one of those things, though, too. Like Gary Lineker's kind of dropped off the face of the earth in terms of the NBC broadcast. They never announced anything officially, and he did the first couple of seasons. He was very involved in terms of being kind of the on-site host for games now and again. I miss that. I love Gary Lineker, but in some ways, though, too, that this team, I mean, from this entire weekend, I mean, I think all of them are on their A game. I mean, there was times where Lee Dixon, whether he's in the studio or on pitch side, I mean, just some great comments, some great observations. You go down the list. I mean, all of them played an A game, and it was fantastic to watch. Yeah, I think it was one of those things.
It's also actually the point on Lineker. Lineker and Bauer both work for the BBC, don't do live broadcasts, but they do match of the day. So I think the ability to use both those guys, not Lineker anymore, although he's still producing documentaries, which my understanding air first on NBC. Mm-hmm. So there's still some contractual arrangement. Just so our listeners know, the Behind the Bat series, from what I've been told, have aired first in the United States, all three of them, which are from Lineker's production company, for NBC, and then you see them in the UK. So they're actually produced initially for American television by Gary Lineker. So there's still some arrangement he has with NBC. Point being, though, you're able to get those two guys, and now just Bauer, because the BBC doesn't show live games on the weekends. The issue with getting more talent, I think, for NBC, increasing the number of talent, would be because BT and Sky have the bulk of the rest of the personnel, and they do show live games.
One of the things I just remembered, Kartik, that I loved about this past weekend was just the not just the interviews. So the, I mean, interviews with Pochettino and Wenger. I mean, huge coups to get those interviews. But just the sweeping camera, you were seeing like as Pochettino was kind of walking down from the players' tunnel all the way over to the desk. Kind of the floating camera, it seemed, the camera just was following him all the way through. And the live handover in Pochettino being introduced to the talent there. Same thing with the Wenger when he was kind of he was doing an interview for Arsenal TV. The official Arsenal TV. And then you can see as soon as he was finished, like, you mean the PR person kind of said, okay, right, Arsene, this way, please. And that was great. And kind of just the way that, you really felt like you were pitch side. I mean, even just the way that the cameras went around the talent. So you see the back of it.
How about right before the Chelsea Man United game when, it seemed like, did Steve Bauer have to retrieve a ball or two that had come his way, or was it Graham Rousseau? One of them, yeah, remember that? And that was that you really felt it. And they were able to and they were live. Okay, this is really significant. They were live on camera when Graham Rousseau seems distracted. He's pointing. Mm-hmm. And what was he pointing at? Alonso going off injured pre-match.
Wow.
Going back into the dressing room. Yep. You don't get that. That was unbelievable. I forgot to highlight that moment, but that was – that showed the value of a pitch side desk in a pitch side studio, which I'm guessing that day Sky didn't have. Sky probably saw Alonso go off after NBC did.
Yeah. Yeah. And Sky probably had just the studio, the studio in Old Trafford, kind of, usually halfway up the stadium, and probably saw it maybe a couple of minutes after it actually happened. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing, that for viewers who have never been to these stadiums, it really pulls you into the stadium. You get kind of a feeling, kind of a look at a really close up view that you would never get anywhere else. The one thing I missed, Kartik, and I'm not sure if you caught it too, was so post match for Man United against Chelsea at Old Trafford. Were they able to get any post match interviews? I missed that part.
They were, and it's escaping me who they got offhand now, but they definitely got. Did they get a Chelsea player? Even though Chelsea had been had lost, I'm thinking they had Gary Cahill. They did have, and then I want to say they had a United player or two. It wasn't Ashley Young, who had captained the side, by the way, in a surprise move. It wasn't Fellaini. I can't recall who it was, but they did get someone from United, and then they got Antonio Conte also after the match.
Wow.
And Conte was. He was basically saying, and it was very revealing, his interview, basically saying, hey, you can't blame the formation. Obviously, Alonso went off, and they had to switch to unconventional formation for them, because they've been going 3-5-2 most of the season. And he basically said, look, we practiced 3 at the back, 4 at the back, 5 at the back. That's not an excuse. So this weekend they had Conte. Conte was less memorable because they didn't win, but they had Conte. They had obviously Wenger, which we talked about, and they had Pochettino, who was fantastic. One takeaway was also the joy, and this is why I think Pochettino had such a connection with his players.
Mm-hmm.
The joy he expressed in that interview with Vincent Janssen scoring a goal. And that was nice to see. I mean, that was a manager who was genuinely happy, a player that has had a very rough go of it in England, now is really beginning, I think, to fit in as a supplementary player who can do other things other than score goals. We thought when he was signed, he was going to be an out-and-out number 9 goal-scoring threat, which is, I think, what Pochettino thought he was getting when he signed him. But Pochettino has been able to fit him into the side doing some other things, running off the ball, drifting back into midfield and linking up, things that help Dele Alli and Harry Kane score goals. And now he got a goal himself finally in the run of play. And the joy that the manager expressed in that interview was something that you don't get in the post-match Sky interview with Jeff Shreves or whoever it is with the microphone and just kind of that forced interview at the end of the match. That was something that I think came out because of the pitchside studio after the match.
Yeah, the chemistry between the not just the managers and the NBC talent, but also the players. They felt very comfortable. The questions were intelligent questions. There were some of them thought-provoking questions. Some of the answers, actually from Pochettino especially, weren't your kind of your trained PR robotic answers. You mean, you could definitely tell he was passionate. He was kind of honest. He was kind of sharing his thoughts. And that was refreshing.
I mean, just as an aside on Pochettino, 3 years ago when he was still managing Southampton, it seemed he couldn't speak English, remember? Yeah, and he wouldn't give interviews in English. He is so good at elaborating his emotions and his thoughts in English. I have to assume he actually knew the language all along, because he articulates himself in English better than some English managers do. His emotions, his joy about certain things. Either that or he's just learned it really well and really, I was impressed by his English in that interview, quite frankly.
Yeah, me too. And maybe it was one of those things where when he was having the translator, maybe he knew it, but he wanted, just as a manager, like the way he has his team playing, he wants to master it. He wants to be kind of on his A game, so to speak, in terms of when he's given interviews. It definitely seems that way. But yeah, all in all, I thought it was a fantastic weekend. The one thing I did miss a little bit was Turf Moor. The Turf Moor one from a couple of years ago, I still remember vividly. But at Turf Moor, at Burnley's ground, is such a unique stadium anyway, kind of an old-fashioned stadium. And I was missing that a little bit. So the Riverside and having Robbie Musto, they had about like a 3 or 4 minute segment, giving a behind-the-scenes tour of the Riverside Stadium. That was nice. I enjoyed that and seen the old gates, the Middlesbrough FC gates from Essen Park. That was a nice touch. But the only thing was just kind of all three stadiums. Well, White Hart Lane's an old one now too, though. But they were more your modern stadiums, and I was kind of missing that part. Or at least with Burnley, you'd see kind of the background, kind of the Lancashire rolling hills and kind of the scenery part of it. That I vividly still remember to this day. And that just, I just love that part. This one, not so much in terms of at least the locales, but I mean, it's football after all. That's the priority. It's not a British culture show.
Yeah, although I think those old grounds add a certain character, particularly for American audiences who may not get that. The Riverside was maybe the first in the new wave of stadiums, kind of like the Camden Yards is for baseball. And so that's that still has a certain charm to it, because I think it was really the first of those stadiums that popped up in the 90s and 2000s, like Camden Yards is in baseball with Baltimore. That was the first one, and then there was a succession of ballparks that kind of mimicked the feel of Camden Yards. I think the Riverside was the first. It's not a cookie-cutter ground, but it's certainly not – doesn't have the character of some of the older grounds. And then you had Pride Park open in Derby, I think, a year later, and you just had a succession of them after. Mm-hmm. So I can completely relate to that, and it was different than being at a Turf Moor. But at the same time, I think there was something neat about being at White Hart Lane and the crew getting to see it. And Kyle Martino said it too. My first trip to White Hart Lane, thank goodness I got here before it was gone. Right. So there was something that we will look back on in the next year or two, or probably next, maybe longer than that, 5 years, and say, okay, that was great that they were there for one of the final home matches for Spurs in the league at White Hart Lane.
That's true. So Kartik, what else have you been watching this past week?
Yeah, a lot of NWSL, worldsoccertalk.com. We've got a story that I wrote on Go 90, which is the new streaming broadcast partner for NWSL, and then also Lifetime, which is owned by A&E, and A&E is now an investor in NWSL. I thought the Lifetime broadcast with Jen Hildreth and Ali Wagner was fantastic, and as was their studio show, not studio show, on-site pre-game show and post-game shows. Very well done. Graphics were clean. Production was good. Jen Hildreth is a pro. She's been doing this for a decade, calling women's soccer games. I know a lot of listeners may know Jen Hildreth from being a sideline reporter for college sports games, in college football, college basketball in the U.S. Who don't watch women's soccer might know her from that, but she's actually been basically the voice of professional women's club soccer in this country for the last decade. So she's very good. I don't remember her working with Ali Wagner. Maybe she did a little bit during the Women's World Cup on Fox in 2015, but they were very crisp, a lot of continuity together on the broadcast. Now, Go 90, I had kind of a different take on. I missed the local native announcers, and a shameless plug for another podcast, but I was on another podcast with our former co-host, Richard Farley, here at World Soccer Talk this week, and we got into a little bit of a discussion about that. Richard likes the fact that they've gone with neutral league-based centralized announcers. I don't. So what happened with Go 90, Chris, is that the league has centralized its production and its announcer pool. They're flying in announcers to call games off of a studio in Fort Lauderdale, off a monitor from the studio in Fort Lauderdale, and they're neutral announcers, and every game has the same graphics, the same feel. And I think in a league that's still relatively young and is still trying to develop its identity, the identity of its clubs, that's a bad call. Now, if you're trying to develop the league identity, I guess that's fine. But there wasn't the kind of institutional historical knowledge of Sky Blue FC, of the Chicago Red Stars, of the Boston Breakers, your legacy club, so to speak, in women's soccer in this country, that I would have liked to have heard from those broadcasters, and that I was always hearing last season when I would check out games on YouTube. So that to me was disappointing. I know that they'll work on that, but I was unhappy about that, because I think what you had was an effort by NWSL. I don't think I articulated this that well in that article, to not talk as much about the historical legacy of some of the clubs that predate NWSL. A number of the clubs in the league came from WPS and went through the USLW league for a year or two in between those two leagues. And I think there was a concerted effort not to talk about what Sky Blue did in 2009 or 2010, or what the Boston Breakers, whose legacy goes back to the old WUSA, did. So,
but Carter, here we go again, though, too, because it's the same thing with Major League Soccer in terms of not wanting to talk about the NASL teams, about old Seattle Sounders.
And these are the same clubs. I mean, at least there you can say there was a break, and they're using the same names, but they're not really the same clubs. These are the exact same clubs as there were in WPS in those three or four cases, and there was I sensed a concerted effort not to talk about it, because they used to talk about it a lot last season.
And to me, I mean it's history. Yes, it's part of in quotation marks a failed history, in terms of that league is no longer around. But it's a development. It's the life cycle of soccer in the United States. We know that leagues have come, leagues have gone, and it's kind of a survival of the fittest. But to ignore that, to me is a shame. Especially, I think the history part of it, or at least the local part of it, is important during lulls in the game. When there's nothing happening and you want to kind of, what more is there to talk about? Sometimes it's good to bring up kind of, especially for lifetime viewers too, in terms of these are a whole ton of new viewers that probably have never watched women's soccer. It's an opportunity to kind of educate them a little bit, almost like NBC did when they got the Premier League rights, where they had kind of a lot of magazine shows and kind of a lot of information, kind of like how-tos and, backgrounds on these different teams and the history and why it's important to understand the history in terms of where these teams have come from. I think it's, if anything, it's a good story to tell. NWSL should not be ashamed of kind of the past. And, I think that would be something. I didn't get a chance to watch any of these games this past weekend. I was busy, but, I think it's a mistake if they're just trying to get basically kind of sterile commentators in a sterile environment calling things off the monitor that have no idea about the history or tradition.
Yeah, I completely agree. And last point on this, I'll say that there are political considerations here, which are the internal battles that are going on within that league between legacy teams, like the teams I mentioned, and the newer teams that are connected to men's teams, such as Orlando and Portland actually were the two teams featured on Lifetime this weekend, Houston and now North Carolina, which took a legacy team, Western New York Flash, that goes back to WPS days, and has rebranded as North Carolina Courage, and they're connected to an NASL team. So there is that little internal battle within NWSL, and I think the unwillingness to really talk about the histories of some of these clubs probably relates to that, since it is a league broadcast, unlike what it used to be last season, which were individual teams doing their own broadcasts. Moving on, a lot of championship for me this weekend, Ipswich Newcastle on Easter Monday, Bank Holiday Monday, Derby Huddersfield. I watched some of the Newcastle Leeds game on Friday. I think BN is doing a tremendous job of bringing us the Football League as best they can. Yeah. If the rights stay with BN for the League Cup and the Football League, That's probably a win. Now, this is the big catch 22. If the rights stay there, it's probably a big win for those of us who like to check out the championship from time to time and see what's happening, particularly at the end of the season when we've got massive promotion races and saw that Derby goal late and Huddersfield not put the pressure on Newcastle, and it appeared like they were going to close the gap for that final automatic promotion spot. But if these rights, Football League and League Cup rights, go to an ESPN or a Turner or to a Fox, then I think you're in a position where you will probably have more access and accessibility for League Cup matches involving big Premier League teams, but you will end up losing a lot of the ability to watch the Football League, particularly the Championship, in this country. So when fans say they want the League Cup off of VN and they want it on ESPN, and I've heard that from a few people, think about the fact that the contracts are linked. And I don't think ESPN is going to be showing you an Ipswich Newcastle game in the middle of the morning on a Monday. Yep. I
agree. I watched the Newcastle against Leeds game on the Friday. Very entertaining. 52,000 crowd there. Great atmosphere, and a great end to the game with Leeds coming back to tie it 1-1. But you're right, Kartik, because I mean, ABN Sports had on Friday, Good Friday, had a triple header of championship games. On Easter Monday, they had a triple header of championship games, and you're not going to get that on a Fox or an ESPN. So in some ways, and actually BN Sports has prioritized now the championship above Ligue 1, unless it's PSG. But now it's more likely that there's more and more games that are being shown on BN Sports, the English language channel, than before. Most of them that started the season, most of them were on BN Sports Connect, unless there was no other game going on. But nowadays, actually, in the last few months, I think BN Sports has seen the numbers. They're not astronomical by any means, but they're actually better than Ligue 1, and they've been pretty promising. So
they're better than the Bundesliga in some cases too.
Yeah. So to me, I'd love the championship to stay with BN Sports. I think they've done a good job. They don't interfere with the broadcasts. I mean, basically, they're not. I mean, John Champion does a lot of the commentaries, which I enjoy, but they're not getting in way of the raw feed, the raw broadcast. They kind of just let it go, and they'll have maybe a host just to promo it, and that's about it.
And they've really learned, because the first year or two, people who follow me on Twitter closely remember I was badgering BN every weekend about not showing championship games, showing this league, that league, repeats of games from Spain or France instead of championship games, and trying to convince them that there are significant followings for a lot of these teams because they're former Premier League teams and that they have American fans. Well, now I think they've realized that. They show Fulham an awful lot, by the way, because I think they know that angle. And they've now had Fulham in the championship for 3 years, and They may lose them after this year. There's a decent chance Fulham gets promoted. If they can hold on to sixth and go through a playoff with a Huddersfield team and a Reading team, both that are, I think, pretty shaky, and then Leeds, you just never know, or Sheffield Wednesday. So they have a decent chance of getting promoted. But BN has a couple of anchor clubs that do have followings. Leeds, Fulham,
Newcastle.
Newcastle will be gone after the season, but that was a one-year thing. But they have a few of these. Derby has a following. I think there's a curiosity of Huddersfield because they have an American manager, German-American manager. So there's an interest among American soccer fans in how Huddersfield's doing with as long as David Wagner is managing there. My sense is someone will poach him sooner or later with the job he's done at Huddersfield. We've heard, obviously, Eric Winalda speculate that it would be the U.S. Soccer Federation. But I mean, he might want that. I might want that, too. But we know how the USSF operates. I think they're probably going to find an MLS coach. But the point is, BN has done a really good job at elevating the championship. So those of you that talk about the League Cup and are just want to see Arsenal versus Liverpool in the League Cup fourth round on on ESPN, think about what it does to the championship and the exposure of the championship. Those games will all be thrown on ESPN3, and that'll be kind of the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with beIN Sports too, pretty much every single League Cup game that's available and every single championship game that's available, because not all of them are televised live, but the ones that are available through beIN Sports or beIN Sports Connect. So, actually for listeners who haven't had a chance to follow the championship much this season, I mean, now is the time. I mean, in terms of the playoff race heating up, Newcastle, that still has to get, I think, about 5 points in the last few games to get automatically qualified, promoted, sorry. But the playoff race, is hot and heavy, and there's a bunch of teams that they're fighting to try to get a chance in the playoffs. And of course, we all love the playoff, the championship playoff, final.
Final thing for me was obviously Champions League on Tuesday, the pregame show. They bring Juan Carlos Osorio in to discuss all this, these CONCACAF and Mexico-US issues on a Champions League pregame show on Fox. And again, I go with your suggestion, Chris. Just rebranded the Fox Soccer Report, especially now that they don't have anything invested in UEFA. They're losing the rights to Champions League, to Turner, right? And do they even have any international UEFA rights, or all those go to ESPN after 2018?
They share some of those with ESPN. So I think Fox will show some of those games, especially kind of the qualifiers. But most of them will be ESPN,
Nations League or Nations Cup, whatever they're calling it,
ESPN.
I think an ESPN property, right?
Yeah.
So they're basically out of the European, the continental football game, obviously beyond the Bundesliga,
right,
starting in 2018. So it seems like they have less and less interest in promoting these matches. We'll see today, because obviously Juve Barcelona, we're taping this Wednesday morning. You'll probably listen to this after that game is over. That second leg is over from the Camp Nou. But I'm wondering if they're going to go with a half an hour of analysis of that and Dortmund Monaco, a game I think a lot of people are interested in, because folks like watching Monaco. I think now that Leicester's out of the competition, the neutrals are pulling for Monaco to win today, mm-hmm, and just entertain us, even if they can't win this Champions League. I think most neutrals want them to win the Champions League, but there is something very, at least from my perspective, very uninteresting about the Champions League when it's Bayern and Real Madrid and Barcelona. And Atleti makes it more interesting, but of course they're difficult on the eye to watch from a entertainment standpoint, right? They're a team that just plays very defensively. And Juve also.
But Kartik, I think if Monaco can win, I mean, I think to me, Monaco's an exciting, entertaining side.
That's my point.
Yeah.
I think everybody, for people like you and me, our hopes of continuing to have interest in this competition, real interest and excitement about it, depend on Monaco advancing and continuing to advance. So, I don't know if Fox will play up that angle. It seems to me that they're just not interested in doing that.
Yeah. Well, so like Kartik said, we were recording this on Wednesday morning. So by the time you listen to this, you already know who's gone through. But say between Barcelona and Juve, maybe Juve goes through, and between Monaco and Dortmund, say if Monaco goes through, what you'll have actually, Kartik, which is in a strange way, is the four teams that'll be in the semi-final of the Champions League will all be clubs that are shown on beIN Sports. You've got Real Madrid, you've got Juve with Serie A, you've got Monaco with Ligue 1, and I'm forgetting a fourth one. But all those teams are our Champions League teams. Yes, they're in the Champions League, but all of them will be shown on beIN Sports. So that gives beIN Sports kind of a lift, and hopefully, maybe marketing wise, they can figure out a way to how to capitalize on that, in terms of that we have four of the best teams in Europe playing week in, week out on beIN Sports. So that's a big win there. Going back to what you said, Kartik, a minute ago about Fox Sports on the Tuesday pregame show. I don't usually do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. Feedback or emails from listeners. The first one actually through Twitter is BPL Knoxville, and on Twitter he said, Mexico head coach seems like a good guy, but come on, it's all about European footy on Tuesday. Fox Sports, was that necessary? And then the second one we got was from Oliver Say, a comment on worldsoccertalk.com. And he said, Fox Sports is now in full lame duck mode with the UEFA Champions League product. During the pre-match show prior to Real Madrid versus Bayern Munich, Fox Sports spent 8 minutes in the studio on the following. One, an interview on the set with Mexico head coach Carlos Osorio, previewing the upcoming Mexico against USA World Cup qualifier and the Confederations Cup. And then number two, a report from Grant Wall dealing with a proposed CONCACAF League of Nations tournament, which will replace friendly international matches on FIFA international dates. One would expect Fox Sports to use the UEFA Champions League product as a laboratory in the next 13 months as it prepares for FIFA World Cup 2018. And in some ways, we've seen this, Kartik. We've been talking about this since, September, October, basically with Fox doing this, and now it seems to be even more so. And like you said just a minute ago, maybe just call it Fox Soccer Report. Have it be 30 minutes of just the latest news, reports from Grant Wall, some interviews, etc. And then maybe have 15 minutes of pre-game Champions League coverage, and then kick off the game at 2:45.
Yeah, I think that's the direction they're going anyway. Might as well just rebrand it. And that's right. There was this report from Grant Wall about all this CONCACAF-related news and this League of Nations tournament, which to me would be a bad thing for the United States, because the United States, under Bob Bradley and under Jurgen Klinsmann, I don't know if Bruce Arena plans to continue this, but under Bradley and Klinsmann tended to play a lot of friendlies against European nations or South American nations on those FIFA friendly dates. And that is something that you can't replace that experience with matches against CONCACAF nations, quite honestly. Now, I know that there is a litany of people who are apologists in this country who will call write in and complain and say, oh, well, the Germans never have to travel to Honduras, or the Germans never have to travel to Costa Rica. They don't know what it's like. Well, they have to travel to, like, Moldova and Belarus and these places that have kind of a similar fan atmosphere. But I think it will just create more of a dependence of U.S. soccer on CONCACAF. Mm-hmm. And the important thing to note is that this is happening at a time when the Canadian president of the FA, who is very close to the U.S. Soccer Federation, has become the president of CONCACAF. So this CONCACAF Nations Cup is probably a cash cow. The other thing Grant Wall reported, which I thought was interesting, was that CONCACAF is committed to making sure the U.S. and Mexico continue to play twice in World Cup qualifiers in every four-year cycle, which I thought might be in jeopardy with the expanded World Cup, with the probability that there'll be CONCACAF hosts in 2026. So I don't know how they're going to create that. But again, that's a cash cow. Mm-hmm. I think there were more financial and cash considerations in how CONCACAF operates and then how Fox promotes CONCACAF-related events and entities than there are sporting considerations. And this is something, a discussion I think we're going to end up having a lot over the course of the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Even the UEFA Nations League, which is, in theory, is a good idea in terms of turning these friendlies into more competitive matches, and the League of Nations, same theory essentially. At the end of the day, it's a cash cow. It's how do we market these friendly games and increase the ticket prices, get more TV revenue, and it's all about making money.
And I think for the U.S. Soccer Federation, for me, it's no coincidence that this has happened after U.S. Soccer has had a run of a few years where they've had difficulty justifying the high ticket prices for friendlies that they've hosted on U.S. soil. So just last year, in October, there was a friendly between New Zealand and the United States at RFK Stadium. A pretty good matchup, ended up being a draw, but because it was a meaningless friendly on a FIFA international date, there was a crowd of about 6,000 at the game, and I'm told in reality there were probably as many journalists and soccer personnel and people who work in soccer as there were actual fans at that match. And that's what's happened in Europe as well. You watch these meaningless friendlies from Europe that are on FIFA international dates, and they charge exorbitant ticket prices, and the stadiums are half empty. The players are going through the motions. So I think the TV networks and the confederations have concocted these new tournaments in order to try and sell that these are competitive matches. And they've raised revenue by selling TV contracts, like ESPN in this country has paid for the UEFA Cup of Nations or whatever it's called.
Nations League.
Nations League. As if it's a freestanding competitive tournament, international tournament, as opposed to picking up for a song each individual meaningless friendly. So I don't like it personally. I don't like the direction it's going, but it is reality.
And it has the added benefits, or at least I'm not sure about the League of Nations one does, but the UEFA Nations League has the added benefit of promotion relegation. So actually countries can move up and down the ladders based on how well they do. So that's a whole, I mean.
Right. And I think that is important because, again, there are a lot of CONCACAF people who listen and don't quite understand how it works in UEFA. They scoff and talk about how easy European qualifying is, which it isn't. But what pot you are in for qualifying for the draw, actually, for the Euros and for World Cup qualifying is critical. And you know this as being a Wales fan and being Welsh, Chris.
Yeah.
John Toshack was sweaty about getting out of pot four and getting into pot three so that they would get better draws during his most recent tenure as Wales manager. And Chris Coleman started out the same way. Actually, Gary Speed talked about the same concept. And I know when Michael O'Neill was Northern Ireland, is still Northern Ireland manager, but when he started, that was his priority. So the Nations League is linked to what pot. That's the promotion and relegation involved, what pot you end up in.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, you could work your way up if you're a Northern Ireland or a Wales or let's say a Finland who's never qualified for a major tournament, or a country like that, a Montenegro, who's always knocking on the door and seems to be in pot three or pot two. You could work your way up to a higher status and an easier qualifying group for the Euros or World Cup based on how you perform in that competition. I'm not sure CONCACAF necessarily has that angle to what they're doing.
So I missed the Leverkusen-Bayern Munich game that was on Fox on Saturday. My kids had a AYSO soccer game, so I missed that. But I did come back and watch the Barcelona against Real Sociedad game on beIN Sports. Phil Shane and Ray Hudson commentating, and great game. And it just goes to show in this particular game, again, how defensively weak Barcelona are. It's surprising. That game was on at the same time as the Orlando LA Galaxy game that was also on Fox. I missed that game, but I did record it. And the game itself was fine. I have no complaints about quality of play on the pitch. And actually, pre-game coverage too by Fox was fine. They had Rob Stone and Alexi Lalas live, basically kind of pitch side in Orlando. There was a pre-match interview with Kaká. They had the announcement that Real Madrid will be playing in the MLS All-Star game. And then for the actual commentary, it was John Strong and Brad Friedel. And no complaints.
The La Liga game, I know we're going to get television ratings in a minute, but the La Liga game had more viewers on beIN Sports in Espanol, that which is a channel that not many people get, than that MLS game did on Big Fox.
Wow.
The Barcelona Real Sociedad game had 403,000 viewers.
I didn't see that. Wow.
beIN Sports.
Wow. And that's the thing.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't think you can blame. In previous years, we would have probably blamed the actual quality of the broadcast itself and say like, Fox does a crappy job at doing MLS broadcasts. I don't think that's the issue, and I don't think we can blame that. I think it's, we've talked about this on previous episodes. I still think it's how meaningful is that game? How meaningful is that game in terms of the entire season? If I skip that game, I mean, does it matter? If I skip Barcelona against Real Sociedad, does it matter? Yes, because I mean, Barcelona had to win that game to keep close the gap with Real Madrid at the race for the top before El Clasico. In terms of how meaningful these games are, I think is, to me at least, how people are choosing which games to watch. Of course, Barcelona has Messi, so people are going to watch Messi instead of Orlando against LA Galaxy. But there's enough people in the United States, I think, that could switch and watch Orlando against LA Galaxy and bump up those numbers that may not be interested in Messi or Barcelona. But I don't think it's the actual broadcast that's the issue. I think it's just the structure of the league in terms of, you mean, most of the teams qualifying for the playoffs. So what's the incentive to watch this game when we can wait till maybe late summer when the going gets good and maybe it's a race for the playoffs, but we'll see. What else did I watch? So Let me see if anything else jumps out at me through my notes. I watched the Leicester against Atleti game on Tuesday, Kartik, and as soon as Saul scored that goal, I switched it over to Bayern against Real Madrid. At that point, I thought, okay, it's definitely over for Leicester. I don't see them coming back and scoring three goals. The Real against Bayern game, it was John Strong and Brad Friedel again on the commentary. No complaints about the commentary. I thought that was fine. But actually, Fox did something they haven't done in probably a year or a few years in this broadcast, which I was floored by. It was so surprising. And that was at halftime. At halftime, they showed the kind of a recap of the highlights of the Leicester against the Atleti game from the first half. And what they did is they elevated the analysis. What they did, they showed a clip of Leicester being scored upon by Sevilla in almost an identical move to the goal that Saul scored for Atleti. It was carbon copy, almost to the inch. And in terms of the cross, the header, it was really revealing. I was like, wow. You mean if you're Leicester and you're looking at the tape of the Sevilla game, you're saying, okay, well, how do we stop this? And Atleti, I'm sure, looked at that and said, okay, well, we can go ahead and do the same thing that Sevilla did. And it was carbon copy. And I wonder in terms of who caught that, who actually was the person at Fox that saw that and said, like, wait a second. I just saw that same goal happen a few weeks ago in the earlier round. And I'm wondering, Kartik, if that was David Mossy, who used to be on the World Soccer Talk podcast and is the Fox Soccer researcher there at Fox in LA that does a lot of, he knows the game extremely well, whether it was him that caught it or whether it was somebody on set. But whoever it was, I thought they did a really good job at that. And that was the first time in a few years that they actually did something that was like, wow, that's good. That's good analysis. Let's get more of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And they caught that, and that's the kind of quality control we haven't always seen from Fox in the past. So really good job they did there.
It's strange though, Kartik, too. Sometimes I've sensed this before in the past, in previous years, where it was like, say, Manchester United or some big Premier League club, probably more so in the Fox Soccer broadcasts of games, where at the end of the final whistle and Man United gets knocked out and, you mean, whoever it is gets through to the next round. It's rather than the actual talent on set being at Fox being excited about who won the game, they seem like kind of like down and depressed about and defeated and demoralized about Man United being knocked out of the actual competition. And the same thing happened on Tuesday after that the Bayern lost to Real Madrid. The same type of feeling. Of course, this one was like very controversial in terms of the refereeing decisions.
Yeah.
And that ruined the game. But part of me is kind of sensed that they were disappointed that Bayern didn't make it through, because that hurts them in terms of having the Bundesliga coverage and Bayern getting knocked out. And it's like, okay, here we go again next year. And next year, hopefully Bayern will go pretty far, because maybe that will help their TV viewings for the Bundesliga.
Yeah, I think that had something to do with it. I think there's also a general appreciation of Carlo Ancelotti, particularly from Eric Winalda, and a sense that that game was a terrible injustice, which, in my opinion, it was. And it was, you know, it's difficult to feel bad for Bayern, because they've been on the receiving end in the past of some calls that have won them this competition, most notably 1975 against Leeds United in the final. Leeds one shot at winning that trophy. But, yeah, yesterday was pretty unbelievable from an officiating standpoint. And it begs the question, because it was thrown on ESPN FC immediately after the game by Dan Thomas, who, by the way, used to be a presenter for Real Madrid TV, so he's not anti-Real Madrid. Is this a case of UEFA wanting to get Real Madrid through as far as they can? And obviously we know what happened in the Barcelona-PSG second leg. Great comeback from Barcelona. Not trying to take away from it, but I think PSG hangs on without some of those calls, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They got the away goal, and they probably would have hung on. So, and I, of course, threw out on Twitter, which got a lot of likes and retweets, I hope that Allegri is training with 10 men this week, because Juve can expect some hostility from the officials. Again, we're taping this before that match. But Dan Thomas threw it out on ESPN FC, and it was almost I think kind of accepted by Craig Burley and Steve Nichol on the panel that there is something funny going on, or just that the officials are really off their game and you need to have video replay. and that Ancelotti is such a gentleman that he just says that's football. And 99% of the managers would have ranted and raved. I can't remember if it was Burley who said that, or if it might have been Winalda or Lawless after the on the Fox broadcast. But that's correct. But I think that the Fox reaction of depression had to do with how that match had gone down. Yeah. There have been a lot of Fox has been in this uncomfortable position, I think, of having a lot of matches like that on their network. Remember the Panama-Mexico game in the Gold Cup a couple of years ago, and how angry Eric Winalda was, just angry about the way that game had gone down and how Panama had been eliminated. And I just think it's bad luck for them that they keep having these matches. But I sensed it was more about the officials than anything else, not just that, hey, Bayern is a property on our network and these other teams are on BN. I don't think that was quite it.
Yeah, and in the past, though, too, I think, actually for the Barcelona, kind of the PSG game where there were definitely some questionable calls, and then this game on Tuesday, I think part of it is just the pressure from the home fans. I mean, the Barcelona fans and the Real Madrid fans in those respective games. I mean, the amount of noise, and it's a tough position for the referee to make a kind of a clear-cut good decision when you've got, 90,000, 80,000 fans on your back screaming and shouting at you. I wouldn't like to have that job at all. One more thing that Fox did this past week was, extremely surprising, and probably 99.9% of our listeners, didn't even notice that this even happened. But I happened to catch it just by accident. But, what Fox did on their Facebook page, for last week's Europa League games is what they did was actually had a Facebook Live. And what they did, that somebody had one of the cameras and they went back, into the production studio and showed, what happens live, during Multi-Match 90. And Multi-Match 90 is their whip around show. It's something that they don't promote very, very much. It's usually on Fox Soccer Plus and Fox Soccer To Go. And what it is a whip-around show of all the games that have been shown at that same time. And they go from game to game to game as goals happen or incidents happen. So the Facebook Live, I enjoyed watching it. It was really, really good. It was eye-opening to me to see how many people were working on making Multi-Match 90 happen in the production room. And they went through and showed how the staff, they're basically standing in the production room watching all the monitors happening for all the different games happening and just trying to see whenever something happens in the game and kind of calling it out, like, hey, Besiktas against Lyon, the game has been postponed or temporarily postponed due to, like, fan violence. So the interesting thing kind of behind the scenes, though, too, is that they take great pride whenever a live goal was shown on the main Multi-Match 90 broadcast. So they were kind of counting how many times they actually show that rather than a goal happening in a game that they're not showing. And then they have to switch to and show kind of on delay or basically a couple of minutes afterwards. The other thing I enjoyed watching, too, was how they tackled the issue of the Lyon Besiktas game in terms of it being delayed due to crowd violence. One thing that is showed is that they have no communication with UEFA, because you expect at least having UEFA, kind of having the rights to a UEFA game, that there would be a contact person or somebody to talk to give them a live update or live information back to what was happening. So what they had to do was rely on the same things that we do, which is looking at the TV screens, looking for any clues or hints in terms of what was happening, as well as the official Twitter accounts to get the breaking news as it was happening. So that was eye-opening. And also, they did a behind-the-scenes tour of the Fox building there, and you got to see kind of the office where Keith Costigan and Alexi Lalas were sitting in doing the commentating the Anderlecht against Man United game off the monitor. Just a small little office, similar to what BN Sports has used in the past. But it was good. It was good. I really enjoyed watching it. It kind of gave us a good appreciation for Multi-Match 90. And it's one of those things that I don't think they promoted that much because they don't want the FS1 and FS2 broadcasts to be impacted severely in terms of, the TV ratings going down. But if you are into football and you do want to watch all the matches, I highly recommend, Multi-Match 90, if you haven't done so already. So, Kartik, let's move on to the next segment, and that is talking about buying tickets. Buying tickets to sports events can be way too complicated, but there is a better, simpler way to buy, and that's with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. With the seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets in just two taps. SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed, and there's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team or musician in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. Now, I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. You can basically be anywhere and just open up the app, and just with a couple of taps, you can find out ticket prices or how many tickets are left for sale. For example, I've been looking at the ICC games for this summer. The user experience is really easy to use, pretty simple. SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And with the ICC this summer, that's key in terms of finding all the different options and finding which ones you're looking for and which are the best prices, because there's so many different things to choose from. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with full confidence. And best of all, listeners to the World Soccer Talk podcast get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code WSTPOD today. That's promo code WSTPOD for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Now, Kartik, moving on to TV streaming news. The big news that came out this past week, and actually still be in sports, that hasn't officially announced it, but for the El Clasico, which is this Sunday, which is going to be live on beIN Sports and beIN Sports and Espanol, beIN Sports is going to have, I believe it's four different cameras, exclusive cameras, so they're going to have four separate feeds. So you'll have the game that's on beIN Sports and on beIN Sports and Espanol in English and in Spanish. But then they're going to have four separate feeds on beIN Sports Connect. So they're going to have an ISO of Real Madrid. So those cameras will follow Real Madrid around the game. Just you watch their players if you just want to watch their players. They have one on Barcelona on a separate feed. They also have a feed that's a second screen experience. But there's a whole bunch of different feeds. So there's definitely something to check out on beIN Sports Connect. I'm sure they'll be revealing some more details soon in terms of the coverage. But it looks like on the English side, they'll probably have about 3 hours of pre-game coverage. The game kicks off at 2:45 on Eastern on Sunday. And Barcelona has to win this game. I mean, the pressure's on them. They're 3 points behind. They're playing at Santiago Bernabéu, so Barcelona has to win this one. So
and Madrid has a game in hand still, I believe.
Yeah, so it's going to be a big test for Barcelona in this one to see what they can do. So Kartik, what's the latest news on your side?
Yeah, so Serie A is going to play Christmas week and New Year's week this coming season, which was quite a shock to me. They've typically broken right before Christmas, and remember, it's a very Catholic country, and players have family commitments, and then resume the weekend after New Year's. Now, this coming year, World Cup year, this coming season, they're going to break right after New Year's and come back in late January. So, same length of break, same length of time, but they're playing through Christmas and New Year's. And let's see how the attendances are and how it's received in Italy, because perhaps this is something they continue doing into the future.
Yeah, and in other news, Kartik, NBC's reached a deal with their TV affiliates. So NBC nationwide broadcast NBC kind of over the air. NBC owns, I think it's about a dozen or about 20 NBC stations nationwide. But there's a bunch of affiliate stations, so that these affiliate stations show NBC broadcasts over the air in the local regions. But NBC doesn't own those stations. So what NBC has done, they've done a deal with the TV affiliates. To allow them, if they want to, they can opt in to internet video distribution agreements. So, for example, Sling TV, Fubo TV, PlayStation View, etc. When NBC does a deal with these different streaming companies, the affiliates have an option to be included in these contracts. So the plus to us, the viewers, is that as of right now, if you want to watch, say if it's a game, a Premier League game that's on NBC this Saturday at 12:30 Eastern time, but it's on your local NBC affiliate, as of today, depending on where you live, you may or may not be able to watch that through Sling TV or through Fubo TV. But with this deal in place, hopefully a lot of these affiliates will sign up to the deal and say, yes, include us in these options so we can get some additional revenue from NBC. And hopefully that means that at the end of the day, hopefully in the next coming weeks or months, we'll see more and more NBC local over-the-air affiliates added to your Sling TV and to your Fubo TV, etc. So that's good news for soccer fans, especially for fans of the Premier League who are unable right now to watch those games locally because your local affiliate doesn't have an agreement. So anyway, long story short, it's good news for Premier League fans in the USA. Now, Kartik, on to the TV ratings from this past week. Some interesting numbers. I'll just go through a couple. But so Man United against Chelsea, the game that was on NBCSN, that one was 816,000 viewers on the Sunday broadcast from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern, and that is the second best for a Premier League match on cable this season. The number one so far for the NBC has been Liverpool against Man United on January the 15th of this year. So pretty big numbers, 816,000 for the Man United against Chelsea game there. In terms of the other numbers, anything else jump out at you?
Wait a second, was the Liverpool-Manchester United match, were those numbers purely NBCSN numbers? Because yep. Remember, the second half was on NBC, yep. On over the air.
Exactly. So combining those numbers together, the Liverpool-Man United that was on NBCSN and NBC, it was over 1 million. But just for the NBCSN number, for Liverpool-Man United, it was, I guess it was greater than 816,000.
Okay.
But yeah, I think it was 900 and something, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, so a couple of significant things here. I think Southampton at Man City on NBC, 784,000 viewers. That really surprised me. There was a Bundesliga game between Bayern and Bayer Leverkusen on at the very same time on Fox that didn't do a particularly good number, just over 300,000. So that surprised me. Again, shows the Premier League versus Bundesliga are a debate. You could have two teams with by Bundesliga standards, big followings in the United States. Bayern is a European powerhouse, playing on an over-the-air network at the same time as two teams. Man City has developed more of a following the last few seasons, but they're not Man United, they're not Chelsea, they're not Arsenal, they're not Liverpool, playing against Southampton, who doesn't have a U.S. following, and that gets a higher rating. I thought the significant takeaway number of the weekend, and I'm sorry, people who are MLS fans for some reason don't like us reporting factual numbers. And the league doesn't seem to like it either. But Orlando versus LA Galaxy on over-the-air Fox, just 246,000 viewers. It was beat by a Crystal Palace-Leicester game, two teams fighting relegation without a U.S. following, on NBCSN at 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific, had more viewers than that match. And also significantly, at the very same time, I mentioned it earlier in the broadcast, in the show, Barcelona and Real Sociedad on BN Sports Espanol, which I believe is in about 12 or 13 million homes, right? Maybe slightly more homes than that. 403,000 viewers versus the 346,000 viewers for Orlando LA Galaxy, which would have been on in about 100 million homes. So,
right.
Would have been available in 100 million homes, excuse me. So that, to me, is a really bad statement about where MLS sits right now with a regular season broadcast. And look, we don't make up these numbers. I feel compelled to defend us.
Actually, a slight correction, though. You said 246 for Orlando LA Galaxy.
346. Yeah.
But still, everything else you said in terms of how Crystal Palace against Leicester and these other games had more viewers than Orlando against LA Galaxy are valid, completely correct also. But yeah, I think it's one of those things, Kartik. I think, to me at least, the gig is up. I mean, I think viewers in the United States are voting essentially with what they watch. So, I mean, we've seen Liga MX numbers are through the roof. I mean, double the Premier League. So Liga MX is crazy numbers, which is fantastic. Then you've got the Premier League, which is averaging, I think, about 450 to 500,000 viewers. And that's across all games, across all, I mean, they show so many games. But the gig is up, I think, as far as Major League Soccer is that there's less interest. So 346,000 on over the air Fox. That channel is in 112 million homes. Compared.
Yeah.
So it's huge numbers. I mean, those should be, it should be guaranteed nothing less than 500,000. So there's a reason that people are not watching these games. Yes, Barcelona was on it at the same time. But not everyone gets beIN Sports. And whenever there's a game on beIN Sports, people complain. But people are not watching these games. And I still think my personal thing is that it's just the games aren't as meaningful. And later in the season, hopefully those numbers will increase. But the other interesting thing, Kartik, is that, which is smart in a way, but in dumb in another way, but Fox is now pairing up the Bundesliga with MLS, with doubleheaders. So we had the Leverkusen against Bayern Munich game, and then right after that was this one. Now, this weekend is the Chelsea Spurs FA Cup semi-final, and in some ways you would think that maybe Fox would say, okay, well, let's actually have the doubleheader with the FA Cup, and then right after that have the MLS crowd game then, and have maybe bigger numbers. Well, the numbers for the FA Cup would be much greater than for the Bundesliga, and then hoping that the FA Cup crowd sticks around and watches the MLS game. They're not doing that this weekend. But again, MLS and Bundesliga and Fox are kind of joined at the hip. So long term, it makes sense for Fox to kind of try to promote the Bundesliga coverage, which is hoping that that'll help the MLS coverage. But we know that the Bundesliga numbers are low, and we know that the MLS numbers are low. So it's almost like a sinking ship in a way, though, too, is that they're not really helping each other out. I don't think there's some overlap, but there isn't a great amount of people going to Bundesliga games, watching those games, and then switching to the MLS game that's on right after that. So it's, worrying numbers in a way. I mean, hopefully ESPN can do a better job. The Univision numbers so far that they've had so far this season, their numbers are way down. But it's going to be a tough year for Major League Soccer when it comes to TV ratings. So Kartik, looking at the other TV ratings numbers, one of the ones we didn't mention was the Lifetime one. So that was, I believe it was 82,000 viewers for the Portland Thorns against Orlando Pride. So pretty decent for the first game on the season opener. Has to start somewhere. It's not too bad. So hopefully that'll increase over time. And anything else? Any other numbers that jump out at you?
No, and I guess I admit I plead guilty not watching that MLS game. I normally would have watched it, but that game, the Lifetime game, was on at the very same time that Thorns versus the Thorns versus Orlando Pride game, and that also created a little bit of problem for Orlando fans, right? Because they had two teams playing at once, so I can understand to a certain extent some of the difficulty with that rating because of that women's game.
Yeah. But that's the thing, though, too. At the end of the day, I think with Major League Soccer, there are always other options. Well, for the most part. I mean, and that's the thing, though, too. That's the height of the season, to me, should be July and August. I mean, where you have the playoffs and the MLS Cup, where there's very little competition in terms of those times of the year, where the calendar is a lot more wide open. But again, we talked about this one on other shows, let's move on. So listener mailbag, we have an email from Anthony Bello, and he says, Gaffer, your idea of a Northern and Southern Conference for Major League Soccer gave me an idea. How about when the league gets to 28 teams, the league divides into four conferences of seven teams? You would have a Northeast, South, Central, and West. Each team would play two matches against each team in their conference, and one game against every other team in the league. That would be 33 matches. You would stagger the schedule so that the Northeast and Central teams are on the road, At the same time, I guess that the Southern and Western teams are going into and out of the winter break. And then the top two teams in each conference make the playoff. Kartik, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I kind of like it. I mean, in fact, I have to say that there's a lot of debate in my head as to how many conferences and how geographically localized we should make competition in this country. And I'm right now inclined towards as much as makes sense. So, four conferences of seven, to me, makes a lot of sense. And it also limits travel. And I also have to mention, travel affects the quality of play. One of the factors for why MLS may be less compelling viewing on television is that these teams are traveling great distances to get to the town that they're playing in, unlike in Europe. So, and it's in the middle of the summer. The heat is prohibitive. Weather is prohibitive. So I think, anything that can make the competition more interesting and compelling and more localized will benefit American soccer and MLS on television, quite frankly.
Yeah, the regional aspect I like a lot. And there's definitely a lot of rivalries on a regional kind of basis, kind of whether it's, Southeastern with Orlando and hopefully in the future Tampa Bay, but Atlanta and so on and so forth. Definitely some interesting ideas there. Clinton Cam sent in an email. He said, I was watching the Man United against Chelsea match on Sunday, and I noticed during the game that there was a couple of handballs done by the United players. One of the obvious ones was by Ander Herrera, which ended up leading to the goal from Rashford. While his hand was already extended out, the ball hit his hand by accident, and somehow the ball managed to luckily be advantageous in Herrera's position, as he immediately sent that pass to Rashford. As much as I'm a Man United fan, I was relieved with Madley not calling the handball. If I was the referee and I saw that, I would have blown the whistle for the Chelsea free kick, even if it was an accident. How can the referees improve the consistency of their calls when errors like this happen? What are your thoughts on this one, Kartik?
I don't know. It's a $100 million question. Yeah. I guess it's going to have to be video replay or some sort of mechanism that evens these things out and takes a second look, but does it quickly enough to where it doesn't impede the way the flow of the match.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, though, too. There's a lot of subjectivity to it. I mean, was it natural or unnatural? And sometimes you look at something and go, okay, yeah, almost have to think about how the player was thinking. And I don't know. It's video assistant referees would definitely help in that instance. But I'm sure in terms of TV broadcasts, I think most of the NBC folks that were, analyzing the game on NBC Sports, I think most of them said that, yes, it was a handball, but, I think it was okay to let it go. It wasn't intentional. It was no way that he could have done it. Basically kind of a hand to ball type of thing. But it is difficult, and probably on Sky or wherever else around the world, they probably thought, okay, yeah, that should have been a handball. So it's just extremely difficult. I think video assistant referees would help, but they're not going to help in all cases. I think there's some things that still, it's a judgment call in terms of whether that was intentional or not. So questions, feedback, let us know through email at web@worldsoccertalk.com, through Twitter at WSoccerTalk, or through Facebook at facebook.com/WorldSoccerTalk. So Kartik, let's move on to our featured topic of the week, and that is which European soccer league will be the most popular in the U.S. in the next decade. What's your thoughts on this one?
I think it will likely be La Liga, and let me explain this. And right now, obviously, it's the Premier League. The Premier League has had a long run. It's the most popular league in the United States. I think it will be a horse race, but Brexit and the upcoming UK general election, which was just called by Prime Minister Theresa May yesterday, will impact this. My feeling is that you will see less and less top foreign players go to the Premier League in a time where, because they're out of the EU, the Bosman rule doesn't apply, and it's not easy for players who are not national team players who have a significant number of national team caps, national team regulars, I should say, not just national team players, national team regulars, to get a work permit to play for English clubs in the Premier League. So you will have diminishing number of top foreign players, particularly French, Belgian, Italian, Spanish. There are fewer talent players, but Spanish, the guys who don't play regularly for Spain's national team but make such an impact in the Premier League, number of guys who play don't necessarily play for Belgium all the time or France all the time, but make a fantastic impact in the Premier League, the Netherlands also, those four countries especially, but everybody else as well. You'll see a diminishing quality of the Premier League, a diminishing interest. Now, I also think you will also see a situation where, because the Premier League is more competitive at the top than La Liga, we're already seeing some of this, where there are Manchester United fans who became Manchester United fans because they were winning every year, mm-hmm. who now are less interested in the Premier League because they're finishing fourth or fifth every year. Same thing with Arsenal fans. Same thing with I think Liverpool fans are a different breed. They support their club regardless. But you see it with some Arsenal fans. You see some disinterest with people who became Man City fans because they were first or second in the league every year and now are finishing fourth every year. So that's a challenge for the Premier League. So I think these are things that work against the Premier League. And what's working for La Liga is the consistency of Barcelona and Real Madrid, the footprint of those two clubs in the United States, and the ethnic tie between Latinos in this country and Spain. There are a lot of people who have no connection to England that watch the Premier League, who pick a club arbitrarily, who may lose interest when that club falls out of the Premier League and gets relegated, like we've seen happen with Fulham, or is not winning titles constantly, like we've seen with Manchester United. That all having been said, I still think it's very competitive. We could list about 100 reasons why the Premier League is strong and will remain strong in the United States. It's just, will it be stronger than La Liga? I think it all depends on where La Liga's television contract ends up. My prediction is, if La Liga ends up on Turner Sports or on some network with that kind of distribution, and we have a hard Brexit in the UK, and the ability of Premier League clubs to sign players from the European Union is adversely affected, La Liga will surpass the Premier League in the United States in the next 5 to 7 years.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's all about the TV product. So when we ask, like, kind of which European soccer league will be the most popular in the US in the next decade, that's really dictated by television, because, you mean, if it's difficult to find that league on television, even if it's the best league, it's probably not going to do that well. And, La Liga to me is a league that has outgrown beIN Sports. So I think beIN Sports, say 3 or 4 years ago, when they acquired the rights to La Liga, at the time, the production quality from television for La Liga was just like Serie A. It was pretty poor. Nothing like the Premier League in terms of the number of cameras, the number of camera angles, all the replays, and just all of the, kind of even where the position of the cameras in the stadiums. So in the last 3 or 4 years, the last 2 years especially, La Liga has improved incredibly in terms of the television production, and now is at a level where it's pretty close to the Premier League. And in some ways, when there's games at Barcelona or at Real Madrid Stadium, in some ways it may even be surpassing the Premier League in terms of the television coverage side of things. So on the football, going back to the football side, I mean, you look at the Champions League now, Kartik, for the past, I don't know, 5 years, or even the Europa League too, combine those two together, it's been complete domination, really, by the Spanish clubs. I mean, Sevilla in Europa League, I mean, this season, not so much, but in previous years, it's been Sevilla winning the title for the Europa League, or at least being in the final every year. You look at the Champions League now too, and you look at the Champions League and go, okay, in terms of, yes, maybe if Chelsea was in it this season, if they were playing, they could have gone pretty far. But you mean, you look at the English clubs, I mean, they're out of the tournament, and other than Leicester, I mean, Arsenal had a poor showing. You kind of go down the list, really. Man City was disappointing yet again, unfortunately, but it is what it is. I mean, so to me, when someone's looking at the Champions League and looking at the best clubs in Europe and many of the best clubs around the world, they're looking at Spanish domination there. And the other thing too, I mean, even with also with Atleti and Sevilla, I mean, so you got kind of the second string, so to speak, of Spanish teams. And you look at Atleti and Sevilla. I mean, I think Atleti or Sevilla probably could beat any of the top teams in the Premier League. Chelsea, maybe it'd be a close game, but I think in terms of the playing levels, Atleti and Sevilla, those type of teams, kind of the B teams, so to speak, not the secondary teams, but the teams that are less popular than Barcelona and Real Madrid, even those are wiping the floor with the Premier League clubs. At the end of the day, I think especially in the United States, I mean, you go to any soccer park, you go outside and look at kids wearing soccer shirts. Almost all of them are wearing Barcelona shirts or Real Madrid shirts. And the number of Messi shirts or Ronaldo shirts are absolutely incredible. And there's no doubt that Barcelona and Real Madrid are incredibly popular in the United States. We saw that too with El Clasico Miami coming up in July. The amount of tickets that were sold, 46,000 within a week. Actually, within a few days, I think it was 41,000, and then they opened up for general sale, went up to 46 pretty quickly after that. And by this point, who knows if they're at 50 or 60 or 70 thousand tickets sold. And 2 years ago, we had Manchester United against Liverpool that played in the same stadium in the International Champions Cup. And that one, there was a shorter ticket window because we didn't know who was going to be playing in that final until I think about 4 or 5 days before that game. But we had, I don't know, 40,000 people there, perhaps. The stadium was half empty for Manchester United against Liverpool. And that's just a local example. But you look on a national scale in terms of the popularity among these kids, really, of Barcelona and Real Madrid. It's incredible. I mean, my local AYSO, there's a couple of kids on that team that can recite every single player on the Real Madrid team. They know which position they play. They watch every single game. And these are kids that are 8, 9, 10 years old. So imagine them as they becoming, I mean, moving into teens and watching more and more of Real Madrid or Barcelona. That's just going to continue to grow. And you see that to a certain degree with Premier League clubs, but not nearly as much as with La Liga clubs. So going back to what you said in the beginning, Kartik, I agree with you. I think La Liga is the one that's going to, I think it's a slam dunk. Unless, I mean, the big thing is that, so La Liga has outgrown beIN Sports. If La Liga could get onto, say, a Fox or Univision, or ideally both of them, Univision for the Spanish language games and then Fox, for the actual, English language games, I think the numbers would be massive. I mean, we've seen in previous weeks, just the last few weeks, even on beIN Sports, Real Madrid and Barcelona games, are getting more than 500,000 viewers on a channel that's people still complain that they can't get. Imagine if those games were on Fox, or Big Fox, or Univision. Those numbers would go through the roof. The other thing too, I think, the way that La Liga has their, schedule set up, they've been changing things a lot. And it's something with the Premier League. Imagine if the Premier League said, okay, now we're going to take the 10 o'clock kickoffs, 10 a.m. Eastern time on Saturdays, which is 3 p.m. local time, UK time, and take those, and instead of having 4 or 5 games at that time, we're going to have one game at that time, and then move those other games throughout the weekend calendar. People in England would freak out. They would have protests. There would be marches. There would be the Football Supporters Federation would be campaigning. There'd be nasty articles in the press, in the Guardian, etc. But La Liga has already done that. La Liga has every single game that they play on every single weekend. There's no overlap. There's one game on Friday. There's usually 3 or 4 on the Saturday, back to back to back to back. On the Sunday, they usually have, I think, about 3 or 4. And then they have the one game on the Monday. And again, there's no overlap at all. So from a TV viewing experience, if you want to watch every single La Liga game, and not have one team playing at the same time as another La Liga team, you can do it. And it's already happening today. One more thing, Kartik, is that the league, the Spanish league, is making a huge effort to promote La Liga in the United States. So, for example, El Clasico this Sunday, they're having a rooftop party in New York City, I think on Fifth Avenue, and they're going to have Raul there. They're going to be broadcasting the game live there. But this is the league that's doing this. We've seen this in other countries. We've seen this in Africa and in Asia. where the Premier League has had hosted basically, you know, huge viewing parties in parks with on giant screen TVs. The Premier League has done none of that in the United States. So La Liga is already kind of ahead of the Premier League in terms of just trying to do some things, some events and things to get people really, really kind of captivated more so by La Liga and get them to love La Liga as well as loving La Liga clubs. So I think they're ahead of the Premier League there too. But all in all, I think it's if La Liga can get onto it, Fox or Univision, or a major network like Turner, I think it's a slam dunk. I think the La Liga, it's not just Barcelona and Real Madrid anymore. I mean, you've got Atleti and Sevilla and Villarreal. The caliber of those teams has increased incredibly too. And at the end of the day, you've got the best players from around the world playing in La Liga. And as much as I love the Premier League, I see that La Liga, if they get an opportunity to move, which is going to be, I think, 2019, I think it is, for the next TV deal, they can definitely get a slam dunk and get bigger than the Premier League, which is incredible to say.
Yeah, and I mean, I have to say personally, I'm partial. I'm hoping that the Premier League stays on top of the game here in the United States because it's the league I prefer. It's the league I'm most connected to and the league I watched by far the most of any European football league. But I just see all of these things adding up, the case you've laid out and the case I've laid out, which are actually different cases, but they come to the same conclusion, which is that La Liga will likely overtake the Premier League if the circumstances we see playing out do, in fact, play out in the next 5 to 7 years.
Yeah. I mean, just imagine if La Liga had a broadcast that was just as good as NBC's broadcast. And, I mean, this past weekend in terms of all the magazine shows and all the kind of pitch side studios and all of that, if there was a Turner or a Fox or somebody that could deliver that type of, I mean, television programming. And for games, at the end of the day, they're more entertaining than many of the Premier League games. Yes, I love the Premier League games too, but I mean, La Liga, for the most part, is definitely a league above. So it's there. It's possible. And I think La Liga especially seem to be more open to change things, which I'm not sure how that's going down in Spain in terms of how that's been received by the supporters, but they definitely are dead set on the United States, North America, and Asia on surpassing the Premier League. And I think they'll get there. I really do. So, Kartik, where can listeners find you on Twitter?
You can find me at KKFLA737.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thanks for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, Audio Boom, and worldsoccertalk.com. And if you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review. And Kartik, over to you.
Enjoy your football.